I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, France's new leader is moving into the presidential palace, and he is bringing along his companion, her word, not ours. So what if they're not married? But just how do you word that invitation to your son's wedding? Our international panel of women commentators are going to head into the beauty shop to weigh in on that and other issues that, frankly, many families who are not in the spotlight have to consider these days. But first, we want to turn to a new story about our justice system. In recent years, we've heard many stories about whether police and prosecutors around the country have been too quick to seek convictions without adequate evidence and have wound up convicting the wrong people. That is not what we're talking about today, but it is a story about whether a small but powerful federal office has been too hasty in evaluating which inmates can have their sentences shortened. Nearly two decades ago, a then 24-year-old man named Clarence Aaron was convicted for his role in a drug deal. He introduced a cocaine dealer to a supplier and was sentenced to three life terms for that role, even though he had no prior offenses and didn't buy, sell, or use any drugs. Aaron's case was taken up by activists and lawmakers. Even the judge who sentenced him supported his petition to shorten his sentence. 3 years ago, that application was denied by the White House. But in a new twist, an investigative reporter has found that the George W. Bush administration actually did not know about the support Mr. Aaron had or other key facts of the case before turning down his request. We wanted to know more about this, so we're joined now by Daphna Linzer, who reported the story. She's a senior reporter at ProPublica. That's an independent nonprofit news gathering group, and she's with us now. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much, Michelle.
I should mention or should reiterate that you are not the first reporter to be interested in Clarence Aaron's case. As I mentioned, I'll just play a short clip of Clarence Aaron. He spoke to PBS back in 1999 about his reaction when he was first convicted.
I just couldn't believe that when the judge told me that three life sentences running concurrent. I just couldn't believe that this was occurring to me. All I seen my whole life, everything that I had strived and stayed out of trouble for all my life, go down the drain, you know?
Now, Daphna, as I mentioned, you're not arguing that he is innocent. Well, why is it that so many people have been so taken with this case over the years? And tell us what's new in your reporting. What did you add to this story?
Sure. And that frontline piece that you just played was really, really crucial in Clarence Aaron developing the kind of support that he did. Three life sentences for a 24-year-old. You know, he was a star linebacker at Southern University in Baton Rouge when he was convicted. He kind of became a symbol of the excesses of the drug war and very harsh, long sentencing for young people. And that's kind of why Clarence Aaron had was able to sort of galvanize the support that he could for his efforts to seek a commutation, a shortening of sentence. If he doesn't get it, he will die in prison. It's his only possible way out. What we found, actually, was that his case, it turns out, was also of significant interest to the White House, the Bush White House, in its last year in office. We had done a series of stories examining the pardons office and were able to determine that the Bush White House and, in fact, many other administrations, we interviewed people going back five administrations, were really kind of unaware and sort of at the mercy of the pardon attorney and their recommendations to presidents over the years. The Bush administration was particularly frustrated on pardons. They had been looking for candidates to pardon, candidates who would be good to commute their sentences. This is a feel-good thing that presidents do, sometimes wait quite late in their terms to do it. In this case, the Bush White House was very interested in Clarence Aaron and had asked the pardons office to take a second look after the pardon office had pushed for a denial that the Bush administration didn't act on. And so the pardons office went ahead and started looking around to see if Clarence Aaron might have the most critical support he would need to get a commutation, and that would come from the sentencing judge and the prosecutor. And in fact, in Clarence Aaron's case, it turned out, you know, a Republican-appointed judge, a Republican-appointed U.S. attorney and a Republican White House were all interested in commuting his sentence, and still the pardons office said no and, in fact, hid a lot of that information from the White House, kept from the White House crucial evidence, crucial information, and the recommendations from those key people.
And you use the word hid from the White House. That implies that it was intentional. What did they say when you approached them about why they didn't make this information available to the White House?
The Justice Department hasn't commented on any aspect of the story citing privacy, although I'm not sure whose privacy they're citing. They just wouldn't discuss any aspect of the case except to say that each case gets a very good and thorough look. In the case of Clarence Aaron, that was certainly true. His case was examined twice by the pardons office, and the pardon attorney came to the same conclusion despite the support that Clarence Aaron had. But our story also showed that many, many, many people simply do not get thorough looks. The pardons office in the last 4 years has recommended denials for 7,000 people, an average of 7 per day, every working day. So that's a lot of no's.
I should mention, we also reached out to the Justice Department to get a response, and we have not yet received an immediate response. But we also reached out to former U.S. Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez. He was President George W. Bush's White House counsel from 2001 to 2005 until he became Attorney General. And he wrote us a statement. I'll read it in its entirety, if that's okay.
Sure.
Clemency is an act of grace by the sovereign to be exercised by the sovereign with total discretion. However, when President George W. Bush chose to exercise that discretion, one of several factors he considered, based on my experience as his general counsel when he was governor and then later as his counsel in the White House, were the views of the prosecuting attorney and the sentencing judge. Assuming the reporting in the Post to be true, the failure by the pardon attorney to inform the White House of the views of the prosecutor and judge in the case of Clarence Aaron is troubling. That is his statement. How do you respond to that? What do you make of it?
Yeah, you know, I interviewed General Gonzalez twice for the series, and, and I interviewed also numerous other, I think almost every former living White House counsel, numerous former deputies attorney general, and others who served as attorneys general. And, this was an effort to kind of understand how they saw the process. And, my reporting shows that, he's exactly right. His recollections are exactly right, that the views of the judge and the prosecutor are essential. They're not always mean yes for every petitioner, but they are crucial in the success of an applicant. And in this case, where you have the White House eager to commute Clarence's sentence, I think having known the full extent of the views of the prosecutor and the sentencing judge would have been incredibly valuable. And it was exactly what they were looking for, frankly. When I took the views of the judge and the prosecutor to the associate White House counsel then, who served President Bush in his second term, he was really stunned, and he said he would have recommended that the president commute Aaron's sentence. Had that happened, Clarence Aaron would have been out of prison 4 years ago.
Hmm. We should mention that Mr. Gonzalez resigned in 2007. Mr. Aaron's request was denied the next year. And if you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. We're talking about the story of an inmate whose petition for a shorter sentence was denied. A new investigative story by journalist Daphna Linsner found that the White House was not told key pieces of information before denying it. And Daphna Linsner is a senior reporter at ProPublica who has been pursuing this reporting. Let me just take a step back and look at the bigger picture here. You've previously reported the fact that white criminals seeking presidential pardons over the last decade have been nearly four times as likely to succeed as minorities, and that African Americans have had the poorest chance of receiving the president's act of mercy, according to the analysis by you and your sort of co-reporters. Why do you think that is?
This is really an interesting question. Our statistical analysis doesn't answer that question. It doesn't explain why white applicants have been so overwhelmingly successful. But we did weigh for all factors. So you get to the four times statistic after you weigh everybody's sentence and offense and age of conviction, whether they had prior or subsequent criminal histories. We looked at whether applicants had filed for bankruptcies, had liens against them. Every single factor that the pardons office itself says it considers in determining who is a worthy candidate. When everybody is equal, whites are still four times as likely to be pardoned.
I just want to emphasize that because you say in your report, no two pardon cases match up perfectly, but records reveal repeated instances in which white applicants won pardons with transgressions on their records similar to those of blacks and other minorities who were denied. And I'm emphasizing that because because I'm sure there will be people who will say, well, were these violent crimes versus nonviolent crimes?
Exactly.
No matter what. And you're saying that you did control for that in your analysis.
Absolutely. We did control for it. And you're right. We found numerous instances where two people were very, very similar. Two women, both from Little Rock, Arkansas, from the same city, which is, you know, remarkable. They both had convictions for tax-related crimes. One woman and her husband carried out this massive tax fraud scheme. They filed false claims with the IRS using fictitious names, fictitious Social Security numbers to try and get back, you know, tens of thousands of dollars from the government that wasn't theirs. The second woman underreported her income. She owned her own beauty salon. She actually didn't even owe back any money to the IRS, but she paid a $3,000 fine and agreed to plead guilty because she couldn't afford to go to trial. Mm. You know, neither woman had any other criminal records. They both, you know, went to church. They both had good recommendations. They both came before the pardon attorney in their applications. The woman who was white was approved. She received a pardon. A year later, the woman who was African American was denied. And frankly, she was the woman who was African American was a more favorable candidate. She had a far less harsh sentence. And we saw that repeatedly.
We have to leave it there for now, except for very briefly, Daphne, if you would. Clarence Aaron has reapplied for his sentence to be commuted. That's pending. Any change in the system, very briefly?
Not so far, but there are calls for massive changes and congressional investigations at the pardons office.
Daphne Linzer is a senior reporter at ProPublica. That's a nonprofit investigative journalism group. She was with us from NPR New York. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, he turned heads and won $1 million as a contestant on the reality show Survivor. Yul Kwan turned that win into a career as a television journalist and host. He's the latest guest in our Game Changer series, where we're recognizing Asian American and Pacific Islanders Americans who have changed the game in their respective fields. That's ahead. But first, it's time for the Beauty Shop. That's where we get a fresh look at the week's news with a panel of women thinkers, writers, and journalists. Today, in a special shop, we'll talk about the protocol for today's very modern families. Now, there are strict rules of etiquette for diplomats and others who deal closely with the political elite. Most people probably don't even think about such. But then it happens. It's time to plan a formal wedding or other such event. So just what is the correct way to refer to unmarried significant others, lovers, even baby mamas and daddies of world leaders? That question is in the news now that François Hollande has become president of France. He is unmarried but has lived with the same woman for a number of years now. So should she be invited to international events? And what should we call her? And does it matter? We'll talk about this with Pamela Druckerman, who joins us from Paris. She's a journalist and the author of Lust in Translation, Infidelity from Tokyo to Tennessee. Her latest book is Bringing Up Bebe. Pamela Eyring is the president of the Protocol School of Washington. That's an organization that teaches business etiquette and international protocol. And she joins us from Columbia, South Carolina. With us from New York, Harriet Cole. She is the president of Harriet Cole Media. She is an etiquette expert and a contributor to The Today Show. Welcome to all of you. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, Michelle. Thanks.
Great to be here.
Thank you, Michelle.
And as we mentioned, François Hollande was inaugurated on Tuesday. He and the woman who has been called his companion, Valérie Trierweiler, will move into the Élysée Presidential Palace together. They are the first unmarried couple to enter the palace. So, Pamela Druckerman, you live in France. How is she being described by the media there? What do they call her? What do they plan to call her?
Well, she is considered to be the first lady. She's known in the media usually as his companion. I've even seen her referred to once as his concubine, which is actually a legal status in France.
It's a legal status.
Partnership.
So it's not, they're not being mean.
No, it's not a sort of ancient Chinese thing. It's an actual legal status. It carries some legal rights, and it means essentially that you're living together and that you can break up the status anytime.
Pamela, the protocol school. Go ahead, Pamela. You were going to Pamela Druckerman.
But the French really accept it. I mean, I have to say, in the French media, most of the stories about her status have been about what the foreign media is saying about it. The French themselves, you see it in the polls, 79% of French people think it's not at all important that they aren't married.
Well, and, you know, you've also written about this previously, and it is known that François Mitterrand, the previous prior president of France, had a long time relationship outside of marriage. He remained married to his wife, but he had a long time relationship with a woman outside of that marriage, and they both appeared at his official state funeral. And did that raise eyebrows, Pamela?
That absolutely raised eyebrows in France, and that relationship, that sort of second family, was kept hidden during most of Mitterrand's presidency. So there are rules governing French presidents and how they have to behave. But Hollande is basically, and his concubine or his partner, they're basically obeying them. They're doing what ordinary French people do, which is live together in serious, committed, usually monogamous relationships without being married. So, and these two are really part of the French political establishment. They're people who've been on the scene, who know the rules, who know the social codes, and much more than their predecessors did, Carla Bruni and Nicolas Sarkozy, who really were it wasn't that they're basically too flashy. And the thing about Hollande's partner is that she's extremely discreet, and she's sophisticated, and she's elegant, and people are really responding well to that in France, I think.
Pamela Eyring, the Protocol School of Washington, has an entire book on proper forms of address in official situations, but I'm guessing that people consult it for formal events in their own lives. Well, what do you recommend? How would Ms. Trewiler be referred to if she were to accompany the president on a trip, on an official visit?
Well, I think we start with what we call a courtesy title, and because she is not married to him, then if she has explained that she wants to be titled as his companion, then that's what we'll refer to.
But I understand, Harriet Cole, that you're not a fan of this term companion. Why is that?
It feels very casual to me. And, you know, this is from an American point of view. I will say that I'm not at all surprised that France would be the leader in having elected a president who has a companion or an unmarried partner. I prefer the term partner simply because it represents equality in a relationship. To me, companion seems like someone who could also be put aside. But I do understand that this is an American interpretation. But if the person were coming to America, I would prefer, and his partner, Ms. How do you say her surname?
Valerie Trewiler.
Right. So, and his partner, Valerie Trewiler.
So, you know, Pamela Eyring, you know, the governor of New York, Andrew Cuomo, also has a companion, partner, with whom he's not married. She's also a high-profile figure in her own right, the kind of the kind of, what would you say, sort of entertaining guru, Sandra Lee. Pamela, how are they referred to? What do they do? What do we do here in the U.S.?
Well, I like what Harriet was saying. We're not used to that word companion in the United States. A companion could be just a friend, or it could be a pet. So, you know, I understand that difference. And I agree that, you know, I would prefer to see them use, when they're at least in the United States, the term partner, because it does show, you know, more equality, and it seems like more long term. Although he has been with her a couple of years, but what we're seeing a lot of here in the United States is these different titles, women and men, or partners that are both men or both women. They're keeping their own names, and so when we're sending out like invitations, we're addressing them separately, meaning their names separately on the envelope.
You know, Harriet Cole, I'm guessing that people, because people know that you're an etiquette expert, you've written about this, that people, I'm betting that friends ask you this question all the time. So I'll go ahead. What do you do? How do you address, say, for an invitation for a formal event, say, a family member who may have a child by someone that he's not married to? Do you automatically invite both parties? Do you, what if they have an intimate relationship, but they don't live together? That's also becoming increasingly common. What do you do?
So let me be clear about your question. It is if there were a wedding or some kind of formal event.
Occasion in which you're going to sort of you have to make some choices. It's not like a potluck. Everybody comes,
right.
Show up.
Well, I think that you make the decision as to when you look at your whole guest list, how many people can you have? You know, you shrink it down normally. That's what you do anyhow. But when you come to a family unit, even if it is not the traditional family unit, to the best of your ability, you invite everyone. On that invitation, though, you need to name each person. Now, you need to be sensitive to whether or not everyone gets along, because in some instances, it is the father who gets along with the child but not with the ex-wife, for example. You need to be aware of those kinds of relationships to determine, do you invite everyone even if they don't live in the same house? Like it was mentioned at Mitterrand's funeral, you know, is it okay to have these other people to attend that event? You need to bring your awareness, your sensitivity to the occasion. Ask if you are uncertain what they would prefer. And then on the invitation, name each person who's invited so there's no question.
And finally, Pamela Druckerman, before we leave this subject, what about the question? This is a question that most of us as just regular people are not going to face. But the head of state, a head of government does have responsibilities internationally. What are the French media saying about how the question of the first couple traveling to places like Saudi Arabia, you know, or, for example, perhaps visiting, you know, the Vatican, which has a very particular sort of a conservative social values that they prefer to uphold, particularly in, you know, public events. How is that to be handled?
Well, the president's companion, Valerie, has said that, you know, that could be a problem, and she's, you know, prepared to sort of address it when it comes to that. But I think, you know, as she said, there are more pressing problems facing France at this moment than how to sort of, you know, whether or not she gets to appear before the Pope. And there are more pressing problems to French people as well. So she's sort of taken a we'll cross that bridge when we come to it approach. And I think, you know, as someone in the French media said, you know, no one checks when the Saudi princes come to France, they come with, you know, lots and lots of wives, and no one checks to make sure they all have their papers in order. So I think they're sort of playing it cool, and they're coasting on public opinion being very positive and trying to sort of face down the big questions at hand. And I think that makes them look serious and smart and sophisticated, and they're taking the high road, and I think that's a good place for them.
If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We're having our visit to the beauty shop, and we're talking about the protocol as families evolve. We're joined by a few etiquette gurus. We have with us journalist Pamela Druckerman. She's written about relationships kind of internationally. Harriet Cole is president of Harriet Cole Media. She's also an etiquette expert who's written etiquette books and guides. Pamela Iring is president of the Protocol School of Washington. So, Harriet, let's talk about the personal lives of politicians does become public fodder. Right now, the former Democratic presidential candidate John Edwards is on trial for allegedly misusing campaign donations to support and then hide his then pregnant mistress, Ree L. Hunter. And part of the reaction against John Edwards has to be due to the fact that his wife, Elizabeth, was fighting cancer. And it was just a very painful, you know, episode. I'll just play a short clip from Elizabeth Edwards on the Today Show back in 2010, reading from her memoir about the decision to end her marriage. Here it is.
I knew I could no longer be John's wife. It was a sad and terrifying decision. I've been trying to reinvent the role of wife for the last 2 years, trying to find a place where I could be happy and still be John's wife despite his infidelity. Each day it seemed another piece of my history chipped away. There was little comfort or satisfaction. There was no peace.
Harriet, I'm going to give you the first word on this. There are a lot of people who are arguing that John Edwards is really on trial for being a jerk as opposed to for really any finding of the law. I mean, and obviously that's what a trial is for. But from an etiquette perspective, some would say that he actually did the right thing to try to hide this.
Well, let's start with he shouldn't have done this.
Well, yeah.
I mean, he used such poor judgment. And when we think about someone running for president in America, what we look for is what kind of integrity and dignity and, you know, the candidate has and how the person moves through the world, what kinds of decisions the person makes. And I do believe that America and much of the world are up in arms about John Edwards' behavior because it was so unkind and unthinking when he had a dying wife. And he's running for president. I mean, just the manners of it, it couldn't be worse manners. I think in a way he's on trial for having such heinous behavior. And we're angry with him. We're hurt for his wife. And it's interesting when you contrast that to what to other parts of the world, like we just talked about France, living with someone, that's very different from cheating on your dying wife. It's just despicable behavior, and we don't like it. So we want him to be on trial for it. Whether or not it is illegal, it is illegal in our hearts.
Pamela Eyring, we happen to catch you in South Carolina, where the former governor, Mark Sanford, was caught having an affair with a woman. And that seems to have pretty much ruined his career, at least, you know, to this point. And I just wondered about how that is sort of viewed now. Do you think that people still feel that his personal conduct has bearing on his public performance?
I do think so. I'm finding that over the past three decades, actually, the protocol of politicians, you know, we see their personal life and their professional life as one. And it's basically the expectations we have of our politicians, especially if we've elected them into that office. And it comes down to trust. So when you break that trust, like John Edwards has, by having a mistress and a baby mama, whatever you want to call it, you know, that infidelity, like Harriet was talking about, it ruins their reputation in their professional lives because we don't see those separately. Mostly in America, we see them as one. And when you're in public office, you know, you're held to those standards and those expectations.
Pamela Junkerman, you actually wrote a whole book about infidelity internationally and how it is viewed, particularly for public figures. And what is your sense of this?
Well, I actually see it a bit differently. I think that the rules have been changing a lot in America. You know, it used to be you were out of the running for being a president if it turned out, as it did with Gary Hart, that you had an extramarital affair. And the bar has risen quite a lot. Now it's you have to have actually done something illegal around the affair for it to really officially disqualify you. And I think John Edwards is on trial not for having an extramarital affair, but for using a lot of campaign money, possible campaign money to pay for it. And I think that's a kind of tribute and testament to the evolving standards of Americans and the fact that, you know, we are becoming a bit more realistic about what a 57-year-old or a 58-year-old man, you know, what happens to him in the course of a long life. I'm certainly not justifying John Edwards' indiscretions or behavior at all, but I think as a country we're coming to realize that marriage is long and, you know, in real life people don't always break up or get divorced because somebody has an affair. And presidents, you know, or potential presidents shouldn't necessarily be held to that standard either. So I think it's quite good that what he's being tried for is an actual crime, potential crime.
I think we have to leave it there for now. Unfortunately, because we wanted to talk about the whole question of when you draw the line on the past. Did you know that some love letters between President Obama and a former college girlfriend surfaced recently are included in an upcoming biography? I don't know, Harriet, I think I may have time for a brief comment from you. What do you think about that? Is that bad manners or is it fair game if you're going to run for president?
If you're going to run for president, pretty much everything is fair game. I think the good news is so far we've only heard that he had good manners. When the woman said that she loved him and perhaps that wasn't his response, he said, thank you. That is never exactly what you want to hear, but the president thus far has shown that he has good manners in his relationships, and I think that we can appreciate that.
What a relief. Harriet Cole is the president of Harriet Cole Media. She is an etiquette expert. She's a contributor to the Today Show. She pens the nationally syndicated advice column Sense and Sensibility. She was with us from NPR's New York Bureau. Also with us, Pamela Eyring, the president of the Protocol School of Washington. That's an organization that teaches business etiquette and international protocol around the world. We caught up with her in Columbia, South Carolina. And Pamela Druckerman is a journalist and author of Lust in Translation, Infidelity from Tokyo to Tennessee. Her latest book is Bringing Up Bebe, One American Mother Discovers the Wisdom of French Parenting. She was with us from Paris. Ladies, thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Michelle.
Thanks, Michelle.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. In a few minutes, we will remember the renowned Mexican writer Carlos Fuentes. Our own Gustavo Arellano has reflections on his important legacy. But first,
May is Asian American and Pacific Islander Heritage Month. All this month, we are talking to people who trace their heritage to that part of the world and who are what we like to call game changers, people who have made a difference in various fields from politics to science to culture. Today, we have with us a man who has changed the game in entertainment and media. Yul Kwan was an unlikely reality television star. He was a Yale University-trained lawyer who put his career on hold to compete on the mega-hit CBS show Survivor. In 2006. He became the first Asian American to win the $1 million prize that eventually led to work as a special correspondent for CNN and the Discovery Channel. He currently hosts the news program Link Asia on Link TV, and Yul Kwan just wrapped a stint hosting the PBS documentary series America Revealed.
We're going to go on quite a journey, coast to coast, across this sprawling land to discover the habits, the rhythms, and the secrets that you only notice when you step back and see the big picture.
And the career picture for Yul Kwan has also included government. He once worked for U.S. Senator Joseph Lieberman at the Federal Communications Commission and lectured at the FBI Academy. And we cannot help but note that he was once named to People magazine's list of sexiest men alive. And Yul Kwan joins us now. Welcome to the program. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Michelle.
In order to talk about why you're a game changer, we do need to go back a little bit to the beginning. And you've talked about the fact that bullying mm-hmm. is something that you experienced right. in part because of language issues. And it's kind of an interesting story that you tell. So do you mind telling that story about like why you think you were a target for bullying and what language sure. had to do with it?
Yeah, absolutely. My parents immigrated to the United States from South Korea back in 1970. I was born in New York in 1975. And, you know, growing up, I just didn't see a whole lot of people who looked like me in the media, in school. And when I was young, I also had a pretty severe lisp. So a lot of people just assumed that I was a foreigner and that I couldn't speak English or that my lisp was actually an accent. And over time, I became so self-conscious about it that I just became quieter and quieter because I didn't want to get made fun of or beat up. And it eventually got to be a real problem for me. I started developing a number of social anxiety disorders. There was one incident in particular when I was in elementary school that really had a very scarring effect on me for most of my life. Some of the older kids would hide in the bathroom, and when one of the smaller kids, including myself, would come in, they would jump them and they would beat them up. Some of these kids started doing this thing where they'd grab the kid and force him against a urinal, and the larger kids would come up and urinate on them. This went on for months, and I couldn't use the bathroom. And over time, I developed a condition known as paresis, which is shy bladder syndrome. And the fact was I just couldn't go to the bathroom when other people are around. Mm-hmm. And so over time, I essentially became a prisoner in my own home. I couldn't go to movies. I couldn't go to parties. I couldn't go to ball games. I couldn't even go shopping because I didn't know if I could use a bathroom. So this, progressed over time, and it took me many years to overcome some of these issues.
How did you finally figure all that out?
It took me a long time. Even through my early adulthood, I suffered from some of these issues. I also had something known as social sweating, where any time I felt like someone was looking at me, if I raised my hand in class, if I met someone new, I would have essentially a panic attack, and I would sweat uncontrollably. And I got so scared that this would happen and so embarrassed that I started avoiding people and stopped making eye contact. And it took me many years until I got over these issues. And, you know, I also think part of the reason why this happened was because, you know, as an ethnic minority in this country, I just didn't see a lot of role models from people of my community. I watched a lot of television when I was a kid, and, you know, my parents encouraged us because it was a way to learn English. But I never saw Asian Americans. And in the rare times that I did, they were usually portrayed according to these negative stereotypes. And I think
limited language skills, played for laughs.
Well, if you're a guy,
broken English.
Right. You're either a Chinese cook or a gangster or a kung fu master who could kick butt but can't speak English.
Can't speak English.
Or a geek who can't get a date. And so over time, I think I just internalized a lot of these images and I became that quintessential Asian nerd.
Well, you obviously did very well. I mean, you graduated from Stanford and then Yale Law School and, you know, started doing kind of the traditional route. So I think for a lot of people, it would be very surprising that you then decided to go on a reality program. And as I understand it, though, your earlier history actually played some role in your wanting to do that. Can you talk about that?
My parents, I thought, were going to disown me. Like, we came to this country to give you all these opportunities, put you all through these good, great schools, you have these good jobs, and, you know, why do you hate us so much? What do we do to you?
Then we want to take off your shirt and walk around in a bandana, you know, spearfishing. What's up with that?
You know, I never imagined I'd be on television. But one day I got an email out of the blue from someone who's a casting agent for Survivor, and they were looking for more Asian Americans to go on the show. They had a twist to that season, which was they were going to divide the contestants into racial tribes and have a war of the races. And so they recruited heavily, and they found me randomly through a friend of mine.
Well, how did you feel about that once you realized that part of the agenda was a war of the races?
I remember thinking to myself, you know, why would I, you know, throw away my career, right, just to embarrass myself and my family and Korean people all over the world by going on a silly reality show? But I thought about when I was a kid and the fact that I didn't see people who looked like me on television. And I thought that if I did see role models, that it might have helped me along, helped me build courage and confidence in myself, and at an earlier age, be able to see myself as someone who could become a leader. And the great thing about a reality show is that it's not scripted. So I don't have to play a stereotype. I don't have to play a role where I'm speaking with an accent. And so I thought if I did well on the show, I could potentially be the kind of role model that I didn't have when I was growing up.
And you won.
I did, yeah. I totally didn't expect that to happen.
Why do you think you won?
What I wanted to do was to play a game applying all the things I'd learned over the course of my life, working as a lawyer, working in politics, working as a management consultant, and to try to play a very intelligent game that didn't involve backstabbing people. And in my case, you know, I was able to create a multi-ethnic alliance from people from all the tribes, and we ultimately got to the end without stabbing each other in the back.
If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We're honoring Asian American and Pacific Islander Heritage Month with game changer Yul Kwan. He is a lawyer and a television host who began his entertainment career by winning the reality show Survivor in 2006. After you won, presumably your parents felt a little better about your decision to to step away from your budding law career.
A little bit better. They still ask me when I'm going to go back to school and get my PhD. Like, I think that ship has already sailed. It was funny. My father was adamantly opposed to me going on the show. He just could not understand it and was very upset about it. And then it turns out that part of the reason that he was opposed to it was that he'd never seen Survivor before. So he thought it was literally about survival. So he thought there'd be 20 people.
He thought
people
it was the Hunger Games.
You know,
and that you'd
games,
really
exactly.
fight to the death?
20 people on the island and 19 of them would die. So I convinced my dad that I wasn't going to die. But, you know, ultimately I explained to him why I wanted to be on the show. And he understood. And after I won, it brought us closer together because he said something to me I'd never heard him say before. He said, "Yul, I'm sorry." And I'm like, "What? Like, who are you? Like, you're not my father, you know." And I asked him, "Why are you sorry?" And he said, "You know, I've always just kind of viewed you as this kind of kid who's trying to figure out what he wants to do and, you know, didn't really have it together. And then I saw you on the show and I'd seen what kind of man you'd grown up to become. And I was really proud of him. So I'm sorry that I doubted you." And I just lost it at that point. I just broke down. I was like, "God, I love you, Dad." You know, and really, it brought us closer together. So now my parents are very happy. They're especially happy that I'm now working for PBS as opposed to any more reality shows.
Well, to that end, though, do you feel that you and other, let's say, cultural workers mm-hmm. are making headway in what your stated objective, which is to try to expand the realm of possibility for people of Asian descent? And, you know, I don't mean to be hurtful to him, but a character like Ken Jeong, who portrays essentially, he's kind of played for laughs. I mean, he's both a Chinese gangster character in Hangover and is portrayed as an idiot. And
yeah.
So, but then there's also figures like Daniel Dae Kim,
right.
who is both gorgeous, smart,
yeah.
and so
amazingly
forth.
Articulate and sexy.
And you're the sexiest man alive. One of the sexiest men alive.
I think someone fell asleep on the watch.
Well, but you know, that's one of the other issues is, you know, Asian American men portrayed as like sexless.
Right.
Whereas, you know, Asian American women portrayed as all about sex and then
ultra sexy
was Asian American men
eunuchs.
The opposite.
Right.
You know, do you feel like you're making some headway? Do you feel headway is being made,
I think so. I think in the last few years, we've really seen a proliferation of roles and talent from our community playing leading roles. And the fact that Survivor did this whole racial thing, you know, at first it was gimmicky, but the fact is, it did cast more people on the show. And I think the fact that we were able to show that you can have an Asian American who was in a major role on one of these television franchises and not have the ratings like fall off a cliff, I think proved the point. And so in the last few years, we've started seeing more people like Daniel Dae Kim playing roles that, you know, where they're speaking English from day one. People who, you know, take on roles like Ken Jeong does. I mean, A lot of people have criticized that within our community. And even Daniel Dae Kim, when he first took on the role of Jin in Lost, took some criticism because the perception was you're playing these roles that perpetuate these negative stereotypes. But what Daniel Dae Kim told me when he first took on that role was, look, I want to bring a level of craft and artistry to this role that no one else can. And in doing so, I want to create a narrative arc that allows this person to become a three-dimensional character. And that's exactly what he did on Lost. Over the arc of that whole series, he became one of the most popular characters in that show. And so I don't begrudge people who take on these stereotypical roles, because the reality is there aren't a lot of roles out there. But if you can use that as a basis for expanding the role so that people start seeing these roles as fully developed, realized human beings, then I think you've achieved something real.
Let's talk about your PBS show. You mentioned your parents are much happier about that. So let's talk about that. Just make sure the parents know that America Revealed, it's finished its four-episode run earlier this month. The show focused on transportation, energy, manufacture, agriculture. You seem very excited about it.
It's a super cool show. I mean, it's hard to describe just by reading it or listening on the radio. But, you know, we use some amazing visual animation and aerial photography to show these systems coming alive in a way you've never seen before. So the idea is, like, you know, we're surrounded by all these massive systems that make life easy for us, but we don't really know how they work. You know, when you turn on the light switch, how does a light come on? When you order a pizza, like, where does that food come from? And so we use a lot of computer animation and interviews with people to show how these things all conspire to get you the things that you need when you need them.
What is next for you? I mean, what do you see for yourself?
You know, one of the reasons I want to host America Revealed is that, as far as I know, this is the first national show about America that's been hosted by an Asian American man. And it's interesting because even over the course of filming this, you know, I'd go to parts of the country and people would be sort of shocked that I was a host. And they'd ask me questions like, so, you know, where are you from? I'm like, well, I'm from D.C. Like, no, where are you really from? And then they would compliment me on speaking English so well. And then I tell them, yeah, I've been, you know, cramming for a whole year. I hope it all paid off. But I still think, you know, there's this perception, especially for Asian Americans, that we're perpetual foreigners, that because we look different, people just assume that we're not American. And what I'd like to do is use media to get to a point where people just look at us as Americans as opposed to Asian Americans or African Americans or any other kind of subcategory. But first and foremost, we're Americans.
Yul Kwan is the host of Link TV's news program, Link Asia. And as he mentioned, he just finished hosting the PBS documentary series, America Revealed. And he was kind enough to join us here in our Washington, D.C. studios. Yul Kwan, thank you so much for speaking
with us. Thanks for having me. It was a pleasure.
Finally, today, we want to take a few minutes to honor the writer Carlos Fuentes. He started writing when he was 7 years old, and he never stopped. His last published essay came out yesterday, the same day Fuentes died in Mexico at the age of 83. During his career, he became known as one of Mexico's greatest, not to mention most prolific, writers and social critics. His influence was also felt here in the U.S. and around the world. We wanted to know more, so we've called upon Gustavo Arellano. He is also an author. He writes the tongue-in-cheek Ask a Mexican column for the OC Weekly, and he's with us now from his home office. Thanks so much for joining us.
Gracias for having me.
So first of all, why was Carlos Fuentes such an important writer in Mexico and outside of Mexico?
Fuentes was one of the great public intellectuals of Mexico, one of the big three, los tres grandes. And it's hard to explain to Americans the importance of public intellectuals in Mexico. You know, their corollaries would be, say, like Cornel West or Noam Chomsky here, except, you know, the New York Times isn't publishing West's weekly column, like, say, the major newspapers in Mexico City would, and as Fuentes would have a weekly column in national papers and international papers. And on top of that, Fuentes would write essays, fiction, nonfiction. Fuentes would even write plays, and all of his work just went into all the levels of Mexican society. So this, imagine a man with the intellect of Fuentes, but also with the pervasiveness of, oh, let's say Anderson Cooper on CNN.
You know, it's funny, to that end, he kind of talked about this as kind of common sense. I'll just play a short clip from an interview that he did with NPR back in 2002. Here it is.
Of course, my father said, listen, Carlos, a writer in Mexico will die of hunger. You'd better have a law degree. So I got a law degree, and I'm very thankful for having studied law because it has permitted me to do journalism and understand the world better. They helped me as a writer. I'm very happy that I have two professions, actually.
Now, Gustavo, was he kind of being a little modest there, that he really had a deep passion both for writing and also for, as you said, kind of participation in public affairs?
Oh, but definitely a man of participatory journalism. And not only that, he was somebody who criticized power long before it became fashionable in Mexico. He was a longtime critic of the PRI, of course, the party that ruled Mexico for about 75 years. He was a sympathizer of the Zapatista movement down in southern Mexico, not so much for the sake of criticizing power, but always making sure that whatever his critique, it was well-argued, well-crafted, like a lawyer. No one's going to remember him for being a lawyer, of course, but in terms of using that intellect to craft these arguments and really call it how it is, that's where he really made his mark. And, of course, he was not above criticizing those on the left. He was a fan of Fidel Castro until, you know, the horrors of Castro's regime came about, and also some of the other leftist politicians in Latin America.
And how would he best be known to English-speaking American audiences? I think it is worth noting that he was the first Mexican writer to make an appearance on the New York Times bestseller list, and one of his novels, The Old Gringo, was made into a movie starring Gregory Peck. How do you think he is best known by English primary speakers in the United States?
Definitely for his fiction, The Death of Artemio Cruz, The Old Gringo, of course, that's probably how most people are going to remember him. Another way, though, that I don't think enough people will remember to cite is his longtime role as a professor at Brown University. He was a mentor to so many professors. Fuentes was so approachable, such a down-to-earth man. I had the honor of meeting him once at a book signing, I want to say about a decade ago, maybe 9 years ago. And Fuentes, again, the lines were like literally 3 hours long. And he took the time to meet everyone, to shake their hands, to, you know, customize his autograph. He was just, the energy in the air was just so magnificent. And yet Fuentes was so down to earth.
Gustavo Arellano writes the tongue-in-cheek Ask a Mexican column for the OC Weekly. His latest book is Taco USA. He was kind enough to join us by phone from Santa Ana, California, to remember the writer Carlos Fuentes, who died yesterday at the age of 83. Gustavo, thank you so much for joining us.
Gracias for having me.
And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.